Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave.
Welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle's strong voice, back as always. That's our buddy Woody Guthrie singing Jesus Christ. Woody Guthrie, the Dust Bowl balladeer, he sang, "This land is your land, yours and mine, brothers and sisters." Today, some people call it Easter. We know it as a resurrection of all of our hopes. We have a report coming in, many reports coming in today in Europe. I'm going to read a bunch of them to you from the ITCCS head office about the startling events of this last week, including the, as you know, the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral, which we've got some insight into. We're also on the show today going to play a Common Law Workshop presentation that I gave in Perth, Scotland, or to Perth, Scotland, 2 years ago now, May 2017. You'll see the reason why in a minute. Basically, we're going beyond talking about the problem to organizing people to stop these criminal institutions. We're here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Murderbydecree.com is our website. Our program through BBS Radio is now broadcast on 104 stations in 36 countries. So weep, read it and weep, folks, especially if you're from the Vatican. Now, you've heard about what happened in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. The sudden fire, it just happened to break out the very same day that our week of action against the criminal Vatican Church began. Is that a coincidence? The first time in history, in its 1,200-plus year history, that there's a fire in Notre Dame Cathedral, just happened to break out on the same day. It's interesting, the anniversaries that went on this last week, April 15th, the day the fire broke out, 14 years prior to that, was our first Aboriginal Holocaust Remembrance Day in Canada that started this whole campaign to expose genocide in predominantly Catholic Indian schools. April 20th, yesterday, was the fifth anniversary of the declaring of the Vatican as a transnational criminal body and releasing all of its employees from any obligation to obey it. So these are not coincidences, brothers and sisters. And it's about the, it's kind of funny when you look at that image of the Notre Dame Cathedral burning. It's like what happened after the tornado hit Vatican City the day after we performed our exorcism there in 2009. There's a hidden hand at work. And this institution is coming down that's symbolized by the burning tower. I want to read some of these reports to you, first of all. This is from the ITCCS head office, and it came to us this last weekend. I'll read some of the highlights, although the full report is only being issued to active units of the ITCCS. Here's some of the summary, though. The ICCS has investigated the events around the fire of April 15, 2019, at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. A detailed report is being prepared, but these facts are clear. One, the fire was deliberately set. Two, the fire was prompted by the impending Ninth Circle ceremony planned for the sub-basement catacombs at Notre Dame Cathedral on Friday, April 14th. And three, French police investigators and the government have placed a veil of secrecy around their own investigation at the prompting of the Catholic Bishop of Paris, Michel Aupetit. Aupetit's superior, French Cardinal Philippe Barbarin, is a named child trafficker and a member of the Ninth Circle. It's suspected that the fire was prompted by recent investigations by Interpol agents of reported Ninth Circle rituals in and around Paris, including in the ancient catacombs beneath Notre Dame Cathedral. Now, it's alleged that the fire was set by those associated with the Ninth Circle to destroy evidence of the Circle's activities in the catacombs. In other words, it was a panicked reaction. The fire was not meant to get out of control, but it did. The timing of the fire, the very day that of the commencement of the ITC protests, were not accidental, especially coming 4 days before the planned Ninth Circle ritual, probably in the catacombs beneath Notre Dame. Now, this week, we have had public actions of our, as we have been broadcasting for several months, planned actions that occurred in seven different countries. This last week at mostly Catholic churches, but also Anglican and United churches in Canada. These actions, action groups or individuals connected to our movement engaged in protests, brief occupations, and leafleting at 13 Catholic or Anglican churches in seven countries, in Canada, America, Ireland, England, France, Italy, and Australia, as well as at three United Churches in Canada. Now, these activists distributed a leaflet in three languages, in English, French, and Italian, which called on Catholic Church members not to fund these churches. And also they issued stand-down orders to the clergy, saying if you collect money for the Catholic Church or participate in their activities, you're helping a transnational criminal body. So it asked this clergy to stand down from that. We had an interesting response from a number of the clergy as well. We're going to mention that in a minute. Now, five separate protests were also held to stop reported Ninth Circle cult ceremonies last Friday, April 19th, that were to occur in Paris, as mentioned, in Melbourne, Australia, in London, England, San Francisco, and Vancouver, Canada. Because the majority of these actions were unannounced, they achieved surprise and were not met with police or other opposition, except in Melbourne and London, England, where demonstrators were briefly detained by police and released the same day, having not been charged. We find that's commonly the case. The police don't like to lay charges because then there can be a court record, and they don't like any of this being on any kind of public record because it brings a spotlight onto the criminals more. Now, associated with these actions also were special exorcism ceremonies convened by spiritual elders at or near Catholic churches in Rome, London, Paris, Brussels, Montreal, Melbourne, New York, and Vancouver. We find these exorcism ceremonies have an impact far beyond our expectations quite often. Now, here are some of the highlights of some of these actions that occurred last Sunday, this Sunday, and throughout the last week. Now, don't forget, these are sparks. These are meant to be initial actions which will lead to other ones. They're not one-off events, one-time actions. So don't sit back and think things are happening, folks. You're now meant to pick up the torch and carry these on. And here are some examples of what people have done. First of all, Aboriginal protesters entered Holy Rosary Catholic Cathedral in Vancouver last Sunday. Now, this was the same cathedral which was the scene of the famous March 2008 occupation that forced Canada's belated apology for residential schools genocide. That apology was announced within 2 weeks of this occupation. An eviction notice banning the Catholic Church from Coast Salish Native Territory was handed to the priests by the Aboriginal protesters, and it was posted on the front door of the cathedral. A brief scuffle with the church usher was stopped by Native elders, and the group left peacefully before police arrived. Also in Vancouver, United Anglican Churches were leafleted, as was the elite Vancouver Club, where the child-killing cult known as the 12 Mile Club convened on April 19th. Protesters entered the oldest Catholic church in California, the Dolores Park Mission Church in downtown San Francisco, where right outside the church is the site of a mass grave of Indians worked to death by Catholic missionary Junipero Serra, the same missionary that the so-called Pope Francis lauded as a great man with great zeal. Yes, he killed over 100,000 Indians, folks, single-handedly. Well, at that mass grave and at that church, a group of black and Aboriginal activists from the American Indian Movement and Black Lives Matter briefly occupied the churches, confronted churchgoers, and swore to form a permanent coalition to carry on these kinds of actions. At the Marie Rendement Cathedral in Montreal, two individuals infiltrated the mass, the site of Ninth Circle ceremonies in the basement of that cathedral, and these individuals spoke to priests and parishioners. One of the priests admitted knowing of what he called special rituals that carried on in the church basement. In London and Melbourne, Catholic church security were deployed at their main cathedrals in anticipation of protests, probably because the groups in Australia and England were infiltrated or there were informants involved. Nevertheless, activists used a one-by-one infiltration tactic to enter the mass, and they posted stickers and leaflets in the pews and around the cathedrals. In other words, when you see security folks, go in as individuals, mingle with the crowds, and disseminate that way. It's harder for them to see you. So well done, Melbourne and London, for getting around those security people. In Paris, a planned protest at Notre Dame Cathedral was canceled in the wake of the fire. But activists shifted their protests to other Catholic churches, along with a dissident priest who came forward and actually invited them to speak to their congregation, his congregation. Now, in Dublin and Newry, Ireland, priests connected to the Not In Our Name movement held their own symbolic vigil against church trafficking of children. They were joined by activists of the Take Back the City movement in Dublin, that's a homeless movement, and they occupied two Catholic churches and called for the arrest of every top church official in Ireland. And I'm going to mention this Not In Our Name movement in a minute. finally, in Rome, a street theater group performed a satirical play condemning the Pope on the very edge of St. Peter's Square. Activists also picketed the San Lorenzo Jesuit Church near the Vatican. Now, that's, remember, that was the scene of the most recent disrupted Ninth Circle ceremony last month. And these activists at the San Lorenzo Church called for its expropriation by the government and for excavations to be done around the grounds of the church, looking for those mass graves of children. In related actions, and this is also very important, demonstrators picketed government buildings in Ottawa, in Washington, D.C., London, England, and Dublin, and called for the cancellation of tax-exempt status for the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches in those countries, in Canada, America, Ireland, and England, and for the cancellation of tax exemption for any churches that harm and traffic children. Now, those are some of the highlights. Out of those church actions, three important consequences developed. Not only the mobilization of people, giving them a sense of their ability to do something, but contact with various Catholic priests who are on our side. There is a revival of a movement in Ireland called Not in Our Name. These are Catholic priests who want to split away from Rome, who disagree with the policy of Crimensis Satanas, and are actually holding a founding conference in Dublin soon on Friday, May 3rd. If you want information on that, if you're in Ireland, write to itccsoffice@gmail.com and we'll connect you with one of their spokespeople. Secondly, and in related news, the Covenanter movement, which is a movement within, it's a fairly non-denominational Christian movement to bring people out of these genocidal churches. It's offering speakers to help people do what they call an exodus movement, an exodus out of these criminal churches. We have speakers and resource people available to help Christians, whether Catholic or non-Catholic, to leave their congregations, they leave their parishes, and set up self-governing congregations. In other words, giving them the skills and the perspective to break away from these churches and set up their own self-governing congregations. So again, you can write to itccsoffice@gmail.com for more information on that. And finally, as we mentioned before, there is a whole movement now to hold these governments directly responsible for the fact that they're allowing these criminal churches to operate. There's a movement to tax the churches and to nullify the tax-exempt status of these churches. We're going to have a discussion of how to get those tax-exempt statuses of the churches removed. This is one of the ways we collapse their power by striking at their money. And starting on May 15th, there'll be a series of workshops to organize people who want to do these actions, starting in May and carrying on throughout the summer and fall. Also, in related to that, they will, and what's really prompting today's show, is the need to arm people with the skills for how we conduct these common law courts, these common law investigations, and self-governing congregations, which are really one of the answers on the ground to how we respond to these genocidal governments and churches. So, on that note, I want to just tell you a little bit about what you're going to hear today. What this is a play, replaying of a workshop I gave for a common law assembly that was formed in Perth, Scotland. It was the presentation was made on May 3rd, 2017. And you're going to hear two clips from this workshop in a pre-recorded public lecture to the Stop Child Abuse Conference in Perth, Scotland. I provide a historical overview of how child abuse and sacrifice is intrinsic to Western culture. I show how the growth of child trafficking in Europe and Canada was linked with the rise of colonialism and industrial capitalism, the Vatican and the Ninth Circle sacrificial cult are also described. And in part two, I describe in detail how to put guilty institutions on trial in common law courts. Now, please listen in over the next half hour. Take notes. These are very important for preparing for the upcoming workshops of your own and other actions that we'll be conducting with you. I'll be back for the 5 or 10 last minutes of the show for further updates. Meanwhile, listen in.
Hello, everyone. It's Kevin Annett. And let me say it's an honor to speak to you today to your conference in Perth, Scotland. The title of my talk is Crimes Against Humanity in England and Canada and How to Stop Them. It's especially joyful for me to be present in spirit, if not in body, in the land of my ancestors. And invoking our tradition, I call upon all those who have come before us and who will follow after to stand with us now and fill us with their courage and wisdom. It's important today that we address not only the crime, but the thing that spawned it and how to stop it. To end forever the scourge of child trafficking, rape, and murder, and the system and the spirit that spawned it. To see things as they are is to understand that the evil we are confronting, which is destroying our children and thereby our own future, is massive, institutionalized, legally and politically protected, and it's a very old system. In many ways, we are like that little band of free thinkers and Quakers in 18th century England who stood up against the massive institution of slavery. We're dealing with the same kind of slavery, and everything is arrayed against us except the truth. In truth, the evil of child trafficking and murder is not some foreign virus landed among us. Rather, it has emerged from out of the very fiber and essence of our own culture and history. Like the enslavement of Negroes, child torture comes from among us. If we do not understand this reality, all our efforts will be as water poured into a burning desert. The routine exploitation, torture, and sacrifice of children is part of who we are, and is one of the historic cornerstones of so-called Western civilization. Rather than an aberration, child torture is what has helped to create and sustain the power of a small elite class to own and control the world and keep humanity enchained in fear. It's because of this that we are struggling today, and we recognize that what we are struggling to achieve has far greater repercussions than the immediate issue of stopping child abuse. To protect the innocent, we must challenge and uproot the historic system of conquest and empire that is responsible for child trafficking and infanticide. And as we have learned from bitter experience, that system is still rooted deeply in the political, the judicial, the economic, and religious establishments of England, of Canada, and of every modern nation. What we are undertaking, in short, is a revolutionary act. One of my Cowichan Aboriginal friends, Delmar Johnny, put it another way when he said, "You can't skin a mountain lion claw by claw." For the past quarter century, I've been blessed to have been part of a movement that, along with Delmar Johnny and those like him, has forced the lion to retreat. We may not have killed that beast called genocide, but in Canada and in Rome, we exposed its crimes and we tried and condemned that system before the world. We have saved lives in the process, many lives. And we've also learned critical lessons about the nature of what we face and the ways that even a handful of us can strike effectively at this much bigger and seemingly invincible adversary of corporate church and state. A system, whether it's in England or Canada or Rome or Washington, is covered with the blood of children and has no right to exist any longer. I want to share those lessons with you today so that our work can be unified across our borders and so that the few of us present now can generate a mighty movement to not only save children, but bring down those responsible and reclaim our nations from the wealthy psychopaths to whom we have relinquished our power. And in our hands, we have a great weapon called the common law. The sovereign right to govern ourselves and to judge all things for ourselves, given to us by our birth as free men and women. That weapon can help us create a new society in the shell of the old and not simply save the innocent. So my presentation to you today is in two parts. I'll talk about the crime and the solution. The crime is the systemic and deliberate destruction of children. The solution is establishing a new political and spiritual jurisdiction under common law by which the criminal system responsible can be prosecuted and abolished, and a just society erected in its place. Tall order? Well, it's not as tall as you might think. Let me begin by portraying the origin of the crime and how it sprouted and spread from Europe across the entire world, and specifically the links between these crimes in England and Canada. Now, in the original patriarchal Greek, Roman, and Near Eastern worlds from which our European culture sprang, neither women nor children were considered to be fully human. They were the slaves and property of wealthy men and could be used and disposed of at will. This was considered a moral and a just practice because women and children were seen to be sources of evil and corruption in the world. In the Deuteronomic laws of the Old Testament, children who disobeyed or shamed their fathers were to be publicly stoned to death. A woman who had sex during her monthly period was also to be killed for having polluted a man. But these murderous laws and attitudes derive from a deeper religious belief that required routine human sacrifices to placate an angry male god. For example, the Hebrew word for sacred, kadash, is also the same word for sacrifice. To make something sacred, one must set it apart and offer it as a gift to heaven to take away the sins of others. Usually that meant killing your firstborn son as the best offering possible, whether among the Canaanites who threw their newborn babies into the fire pits of their god Moloch, or later in the New Testament where we read that God sacrificed his only son Jesus Christ as an offering to redeem mankind. And this practice of justified infanticide led to the religiously and legally sanctioned murder of untold millions of children as a good and necessary thing. Child killing has been the norm in every complex society known to mankind, but it has especially been so in Europe, where the Roman Empire, and then its offspring, the Roman Catholic Church, institutionalized the rape, trafficking, and sacrifice of children. The slang term kid for child derived from the medieval practice of using the skin of both kid goats and murdered children as the vellum, a document on which to write official church records, such as papal bulls. Every Catholic church in Europe has an unofficial graveyard where unwanted children or those born from priestly rape were killed and then buried in secret. And every Catholic mass reminds the participants that only by literally eating the flesh and drinking the blood of the pure and innocent can the true ruler be saved from sin, can the true believer be saved from sin. This cannibalistic mindset lends itself easily to the routine sacrificial ritual killing of children, as epitomized in the 300-year-old cult known as the Ninth Circle that operates out of Rome, established and funded by the Vatican. According to the 16th century Vatican insider and writer Niccolo Machiavelli, quote, every evil imaginable, even unto the slaughter of children, has been brought to my country by the priests and the popes, unquote. Now, the disposability of children and their status as legal slaves did not end in Rome. The first slaves ever brought to America were not blacks from Africa, but homeless street children from London brought over in the year 1628. Thousands of them were scooped up and sent to the earliest English plantations in Virginia as labor, as indentured field servants and house servants. Over half of them died in the first 3 years they were there. An amazingly constant death rate over the centuries when it came to children imprisoned on work farms, Indian residential schools, or industrial factories. This deadly practice of shipping unwanted children from England as slave labor to the colonies of America and Canada increased over the following centuries. It especially took off during the 1800s, when the British colonies faced a huge labor shortage and needed to quickly populate the vast territories of North America and Australia. Now, as happens in any enormous crime by church and state, the exploitation and killing of children in this manner was portrayed as a humanitarian act by the ones perpetrating it. After the destruction of the Scottish Highland clans after Culloden in 1745, the British Crown, the Church of England, and the Rothschild banking interests formed so-called relief societies that deported countless Scottish, Irish, and poor families to North America. The aim was to grab the land of these deportees and ensure the depopulation of the families on the land. The families first had to be destroyed in order for the land to be grabbed. That meant targeting the next generation, the children. This was exactly the same genocidal strategy employed against all of the Aboriginal nations of the New World by Christian Europe. In a move that preceded and directly led to the killing grounds of the Indian residential school system, the Crown and the Church formed so-called industrial schools during the 1800s, in which children were torn from their families and entombed in prison workshops. There they toiled as slaves and were brainwashed to forget their language, their culture, and their families. The surplus children were deported to colonies under the auspices of something called the Society for the Suppression of Juvenile Vagrancy through the Reform and Emigration of Children. Long title, Simple Slaughter. That was formed in 1780 in London. This society and others like it were established by the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church, which ran its own in-house child trafficking in fondling homes and Catholic orphanages. Now, the death rate in all these facilities normally exceeded 50%, not coincidentally, a level identical to that in the Canadian Indian schools. For the entire system had as its objective the disposing of surplus populations after first sweating wealth out of them. Thus did child sacrifice and trafficking reach huge levels as the modern industrial age dawned. Now, as we know, child labor formed the basis of the British and world economies during the Industrial Revolution, and trafficking and killing children was a normal part of that system. Thousands of children as young as five were routinely hanged in England, hanged legally, for the offense of stealing a bit of food to survive or of talking rudely to their master. The point is that this destruction and exploitation of children was enormously profitable, which is why it continued and still continues today. That system went through three historic stages. First, providing cheap child labor to the British colonies. Next, directing that labor into urban factories, including the industrial schools, which also incarcerated the Indians. And finally, what we have today, the institutionalization of child abuse and trafficking right within the government system of so-called child protection, which includes private corporate agencies that operate behind a camouflage of the state. The state-run child trafficking industry is far more profitable, efficient, and massive than any of the previous systems because it is now so hegemonic and invisible. And that's the case on both sides of the Atlantic. One of the reasons that this system has duplicated itself in Canada as well as in England is because of the monolithic nature of the Crown system of law and government. Crown courts are run by self-governing judges who are subservient to the party in power and the aristocratic power behind it. Historically, these courts have facilitated and protected child abuse and killing. British High Court Judge Adrian Fulford, the Queen's constitutional advisor, has helped to establish the so-called Pedophile Information and Exchange Network that seeks to legalize sex with children and abolish the age of consent laws. Canadian courts have given that nation the lowest conviction rate of child rapists of any nation on earth. And in 2015, the Canadian Parliament actually changed the law to reduce the mandatory sentence for child rape to 1 year. Canada's legal exoneration of itself and its churches for the deliberate mass murder of over 60,000 Aboriginal children is just a more recent and blatant example of the complicity of Crown courts in crimes against humanity and children. This complicity is most apparent when it involves the institutionalized child trafficking that flourishes as a growth industry within the welfare, child welfare agencies. For example, in central Canada, the Children's Aid Society, the CAS, is a private corporation that's paid $100,000 for every child they seize from its family and deliver to orphanages or foster families in Canada and abroad, a profitable meat market with overseas connections. Canadian courts and so-called privacy laws prevent citizens from suing the CAS or even inquiring into who runs them. Similar examples from England abound. For these reasons, there has been no real recourse for child abuse activists in England and Canada within their respective court systems. Judges invariably target and criminalize those seeking to stop child abuse and trafficking rather than the perpetrators. In the words of a senior Canadian police official to me just a few years ago, quote, "In this country, you have to rape a child a dozen or more times for it to ever come to trial, and even then, there's rarely a conviction," unquote. Of course, another big driving force in child trafficking is the money involved. Billions of dollars are generated every year by the trade, which is operated by the Roman Catholic Church and its business partners in the mafia, called 'Drangheta in Europe, and financially underwritten by the same banks that launder the drug cartel money, HSBC, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, and of course the Bank of England. And the system is heavily protected politically. According to Marcel van Versolem, a Dutch organizer with our tribunal, Drangheta, the criminal mafia, pays more than 50 million euros every month just to bribe police and politicians in Holland. So you can see the scale of the child trafficking industry, much of which utilizes stolen children from orphanages, foster homes, government facilities, and youth detention centers. Part of this trafficking involves the satanic ritual networks tied to the Catholic Church known as the Ninth Circle. Much like the overt genocide of Aboriginals and non-Catholics organized by the Vatican, the 300-year-old Ninth Circle involves the torture and murder of children by top government and church officials, including popes and cardinals, at select Catholic cathedrals around the world. These locations receive top protection from army, police, and private security forces protected by governments and corporations. Normally, the senior judges of any nation are either members of the Ninth Circle or are their protectors. We are wading in a sea of corruption, lawlessness, and suffering, brothers and sisters. And the existing courts and governments and their church and corporate partners in crime are a big part of this problem. And they are the ones who pose a direct threat to our children. And so in response to this tyranny, a growing movement to create functioning common law courts has emerged from among citizens in Canada, America, and England to replace such institutionalized crime. And that leads me to the second part of my talk today, what we are to do about this problem according to the natural sovereignty given to us by creation. I'll resume that in a minute in part two. Hello, it's Kevin Annett. This is part two of my lecture. We're looking at the solutions. What are we to do about this problem according to the natural sovereignty given to us by creation? Well, the subject of common law courts is very simple, and in fact, it's contained within my book, Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, which you can get through Amazon, but I'm going to summarize its main points right now. To establish common law courts that sit in judgment of rulers and their system of power is a revolutionary act, simply because to do so, we must first establish an altogether new political, legal, and spiritual jurisdiction, a new kind of direct democracy exercised by all the people. We must do so not only because the status quo is waging war on us, but because those existing institutions of government and the law have become unaccountable private corporations without any authority over us. It's a fact that a private corporation has surrendered its sovereignty and can only govern those who have entered into a contractual relationship with it, which is why we say over and over to people, never go into any crown court. Why? Simply because you have no need to. You are not in any kind of real or implied relationship with their corporation, and so you are free to create your own sovereign jurisdiction in the company of others. That is the basis of de jure common law courts, the fact that now only the people gathered in sovereign assembly can create a lawful de jure court of law. The obvious precedent that we rely on for this action occurred right in England in the year 1649, when the monarchy was legally abolished by a high court of justice created by the people in Parliament known as the Commons. The fact that the monarchy was unlawfully reimposed on England in 1660 by a military coup does not detract from its abolition by the people as a sovereign power. That sovereignty continues to function and allows anyone in England, Canada, or anywhere in the so-called British Commonwealth to reassert their power in public assemblies and common law courts created by them. And the English Crown is a de facto but unlawful power, lacking de jure authority, has no right to challenge or oppose such a sovereign authority of the people, according to this Act of Parliament dated January 4th, 1649, and I quote, "The Commons of England assembled in Parliament declare that the people under God are the origin of all just power and have the supreme authority of the nation. Whatsoever is enacted and declared law by the Commons alone has the force of law, and all the people are included thereby, with or without the consent of the king," unquote. The monarchy, in short, has no lawful authority over any of you. For this reason, over the past 4 years, our common law courts on both sides of the ocean have issued stand-down orders to all the agents and employees of the Crown, including its police, judges, and politicians, and placed them under our own common law jurisdiction. In short, like any great revolution, we are engaged, first and last, in a huge struggle for power. A fight not only for hearts and minds, but to establish the lawful reign of we the people over and against an illegitimate corporate tyranny. Now, it's essential that we understand this background if our efforts to create common law courts, because only they have the legitimacy and power that a new jurisdiction can grant. An alternative political power, in other words, must grant that jurisdiction first to any common law court. A sovereign self-governance assembly of at least 12 men and women in any country. Only when armed with the authority of the sovereign power can we answer the question, where do you get the authority to operate common law courts and sit in judgment of the system? So let me briefly summarize the steps in creating and operating such a jury-led court and how its judgments are implemented and enforced. Let's suppose you are convening a court to try suspected child rapists, traffickers, and killers, and those who are aiding and abetting them. Well, first we have to realize that the common law court is not simply a way to bring a judgment down, but it's a huge public forum. It's a stage where before the world we show the guilt of a system and its actors. The world, in other words, is the jury. We're now not there just to convict a guilty party or institution, but to educate and mobilize the community, because only they will be the means of enforcing the verdict. But in terms of setting up the court, the first step is to compile the evidence and witnesses and to name specific defendants who you wish to put on trial. Without that, no trial can occur. In a common law court, allegations and conjectures are not enough. You need verifiable evidence that can meet the burden of proof that rests on you, the plaintiffs, who are the ones bringing the charges. For your job is to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that the accused are guilty of crime. Assuming you have such evidence, and there are specific persons or groups to charge, you have to present your general case in what is called a public claim of right, which sets forth your case, the defendants, the charges against them, and what it is you want. This claim of right includes a call for a jury consisting of at least 12 people. Your claim of right must be posted publicly. And again, we have a copy of such a claim of right here in our book. The actual common law court is then established not by you, but rather by the citizens of your community who respond to your claim of right. Those people must gather in a sovereign assembly and issue a declaration that declares that they are a self-governing body that is competent jurisdictionally and has the authority to convene such a court under natural law. On that basis, the jury volunteers are assembled and the following court officers are appointed. A court adjudicator or magistrate who oversees the court and gives legal advice to the jury. A public prosecutor to assist the plaintiffs if they so choose, and a public defender to assist the defendants if they choose. And finally, sheriffs, bailiffs, a court registrar, and a court reporter. Since the court must operate according to the rules of evidence, the defendants must be notified of the charges against them and be given the right to see the evidence against them and be judged by their fellow citizens. They also have the right to determine the content of the jury, and so a public summons for them to come to court must be issued against them, the ones who are being charged by the court, before the court can formally convene. Once the defendants either do so or decline, the magistrate then convenes what's called examination for discovery, which is really a pretrial conference in which both sides are invited to work out a resolution. If that fails, the plaintiffs then proceed with their case. That's you. Unlike other legal systems, a common law court is not run by a judge and lawyers, but by the jury members, who have the power to not only come to a judgment, but rule on, revise, and formulate the law itself. A jury can rule, for example, that the Crown of England and the Vatican are child-killing bodies without lawful authority, as occurred in the International Common Law Court in Brussels in February 2013, and you can see that at itccs.org. Such a verdict has binding power and can be used in other courts to issue arrest warrants against the convicted parties, including whole institutions and heads of church and state. The fact that a pope, a Jesuit leader, and two top Catholic cardinals resigned from their offices after being indicted and convicted by our common law court in Brussels is proof of its power. Now, once you as the plaintiffs begin your case, you have to operate according to due process, which means that the defendants are assumed to be innocent, and the burden is on you to prove that they are not. That fact alone makes it imperative that you have solid evidence to present that is not hearsay, but is direct and verifiable, like a living eyewitness who is party to the crime being named, like physical proof or primary documentation. Any documents or affidavits you rely on must be affirmed by having whoever signed them appear in court to testify under oath. If the defendants refuse to answer the summons and they don't appear in court, they have incriminated themselves by their very failure to respond. which is normally interpreted to mean that they do not contest or dispute the charges being made against them. At that point, a jury can lawfully find them guilty as charged because of their tacit admission of guilt. At that point, you have won your case by default, which, of course, is never as convincing as a verdict following a trial. However, if the defendants do respond to the summons and are present in court, they have the right to cross-examine your witnesses and contest any evidence you present. Then it is their turn to present their case. There is no restriction on what you or they can ask, or on what documents, people, or evidence you or they can call upon. Once both you and they have presented your cases, the jury retires to come to a verdict and a sentence. Neither the magistrate nor anyone else can interfere, alter, or influence the jury and its verdict and sentence. Once the verdict is issued, if the defendants are found guilty, the sentence is declared publicly and it must then be enforced. That is the real test and challenge of a common law court, whether it has the power to back up its decisions. That issue is especially important to us today, since those we are charging and putting on trial invariably are powerful people and organizations who may have official authority, power, and legitimacy on their side. How does one enforce a guilty verdict and sentence against them? Quite simply, by mobilizing and deputizing the community and the existing police forces as common law sheriffs and enforcement officers. This is done by the court immediately issuing a deputizing order to the people and the police that brings them under the authority of a common law court and makes them its agents. Armed with this order, anyone and any policeman can then arrest the convicted parties, seize their assets and property, and arrest any of their accomplices and protectors as accessories to the crime. Even the threat of doing so will often cause the most powerful guilty party to collapse, provided the actions of the court are public and visible enough and are pressed home. In other words, the common law court is not an end in itself, but that somehow instantly establishes justice. It's only beginning. It's a catalyst and a springboard that encourages we the people to establish that justice ourselves. Unless we all enforce the lawful sentence of the guilty, a lawful sentence against the child killers and others engaged in crimes against humanity, the verdict made against them will hang as lifeless and unenforced words. Now, I began this lecture by describing how deep-rooted crimes against children are in our culture and how they have been the basis of the power of the state, the church, and the corporatocracy all over the world. When we then call for action to stop and uproot the systemic torture and sacrifice of children, we recognize that realistically, we are issuing a call to rise up and bring down those powers that be. We are taking a revolutionary step. And like all true revolutions, we are challenging not only the material institutions of power, but the mindset and the spirit behind them that allows a few to control and exploit the many. That crime can only be reversed when the many awaken from their servitude and complicity through their own actions, and they reclaim their minds, their self-governance, and the world. The common law is an expression, but only one expression, of that ancient striving of an enslaved and fed upon humanity to reestablish the world and themselves according to natural law and its three laws. The unalienable truth that creation was placed in common for all people, that no one has any natural authority over another, and that we exist to live in peace, equality, and justice with one another. That law supersedes all others and all systems of thought and authority, which is why the common law in its courts have universal and ultimate jurisdiction over every other legal system. The test of this truth is what you and I will do today and tomorrow, so that the innocent will be saved and their killers brought down. Let us do so now, overcoming our fears and divisions that only profit the criminals in power. It doesn't take many of us to begin this revolution. We begin by lighting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men and women, by standing relentlessly by the ones who are targeted, and by reestablishing the rule of natural law in our world against the tyranny of the corporatocracy and its puppet government and courts. For us to do so really will determine whether or not humanity rises or falls in the years ahead. We call upon all of you to take up this torch and carry it on. Thank you, brothers and sisters, and follow our work at itccs.org, murderbydecree.com, contact our tribunal and its common law courts at itccsoffice@gmail.com. And I thank you.
And that was from a lecture I gave to the folks in Perth, Scotland, May 3rd, 2017. Always relevant. And first of all, to remind folks from that broadcast that the ITCCS.org site is now taken down permanently by our enemies. But a lot of the essential material, including all the regular updates, are now incorporated into our site, murderbydecree.com. That's murderbydecree.com. You can see a lot of important video evidence and the references to the common law court trials we have done on that murderbydecree.com site. Now, in closing, in the last 5 minutes, I want to emphasize a few things. These crimes are happening as we speak. We have more and more evidence of how these child trafficking networks operate. There are literally lists provided of if certain people, certain institutions need children, they provide a list. And they're a shopping list, if you like, for little human beings. They go out and acquire these children, hold them in cages in certain safe houses, and we're beginning to document where these facilities are, where they hold the children, and then are farmed out from there. So it's a very organized system, very lucrative system. There's a parallel system of law and police authority that operates. It's called Track B in Canada. It's equivalent to Homeland Security law or administrative law, where they're totally outside the system. And as we speak, our activists are being grabbed and incarcerated in that system. We've had a number of people that have been taken in that way, and they disappear from sight into this Track B system. And I want to talk a little bit about the relevance of this, especially for Canadian listeners, because one of the things that, as we were playing the broadcast, I got an email from a group of people in the Montreal, Ottawa area who are in May, starting on the weekend of, let me just check this, May 10th, 11th, 12th, will begin a series of common law training workshops to set up common law assemblies in Montreal and Ottawa. Very important because we're linking up with the sovereignty movement among the Francophone people of Quebec. The attempted revolution of 1837 of Mackenzie in Upper Canada and Papineau in Lower Canada recognized the need to unite across the boundaries, the false boundaries created between Francophones and Anglophones. So we are doing that in the Ottawa-Montreal area. And if you want more information about that, again, write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com. I can put you in touch with the conveners of that movement. Now, when you're forming a local group to take action, there's two things you need. You need an organizer or a convener, and you need a common law sheriff who's can form the juries, can form the common law courts. We have special training programs for those common law sheriffs. Contact us, and we can set that in motion for you. Now, you know, a lot of this sounds like a big thing to undertake. All of us are aware of our own limitations, and when you look at this, initially the first response is, who am I? What can I do? Because we've all been trained to think that way. But inspired by actions of a few others, you can see the impact this is having. And so we have given you a plan, model, resources for what to do. It's just a matter of you taking that next step from thought to action. The issues are different in each of our communities, but really they're all the same. We're up against a common corporatocracy, which operates with no adherence to the law or due process. All we are doing is reestablishing the law. We are establishing just society, according to the three tenets of the natural law, as we have described. And in order to do that, we need to overcome these false divisions between us. So contact us, especially get our books. The two in mind in particular is the Common Law Training Manual, Establishing Liberty, the Case for Canada, and recent books of mine that have come out. You can find it all on Amazon.com. Just put in Kevin Annett. They're also listed at murderbydecree.com. And finally, in closing, this show costs about, what is it, $3,000 a year to operate. We need your donations. There is, at murderbydecree.com, there is a donate button you can hit. It just says donations. You go to that site, and it gives you a number of ways to contribute. This is a completely grassroots movement led by you and me and depends on our group funding. So every time we try to set up these systems, they tend to get attacked very quickly. So we need your continual support on this. And so please go to murderbydecree.com and donate to us. Now, in the weeks ahead, we're going to begin going into more details of how the movements to cancel the tax-exempt status for these criminal churches is developing. It's developing in Canada, America, and England. And we're going to have the people involved in that coming on, hopefully, and talking about what they're doing, and the role you can play in it. There's one idea that some of the native folks had in Canada was, well, we're going to do our own tax exempt, our own tax into the churches. We're going to go and just seize the funds and occupy the buildings and take back the church buildings, especially the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches. Under international law, they don't have the right to operate. As transnational criminal bodies, we have every right to go in and seize those properties and assets. So that's what some of them are beginning to do, and we're going to try to get some of them on the air as well, describing how they're doing that. So that said, I hope you share today's show. You can go to bbsradio.com/herewestand. Our programs are archived there all the time, within a day or so. And play this program to others. Begin to educate them. Get our books into the schools, the colleges, the libraries, and into the curriculum. This is how we turn the tables on these criminals. Finally, I want to thank you all for the encouraging support you've been over the last while. I know I and others who are in the leadership of this movement are facing a lot of new attacks, a lot of new challenges, and some of us are being actively hunted by the adversary. So we appreciate your support, your moral, physical support to stand with us, especially at this time. But really, it's not about us. It's about the children who are going to die today and tomorrow if we don't take action. It's about the loss of liberties and our beloved planet Earth that's going to happen if the corporatocracy achieves their agenda of mass enslavement of our people. So with that note, I invite you to come back, carry on the torch, be inspired by these actions that happened over the last week, and know that you can take this action where you are. Write to us. We can send you stickers, leaflets, banners, other ways of confronting these criminal churches and other bodies. So write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com, and follow the work continually at murderbydecree.com. Until next week, I thank you. This is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Go Voice. Stay strong and stay clear.
There's a man by my side walking. There's a voice within me talking. There's